What's up? Hey, Brave Dave, we finished the episode. I've been talking about it the last couple of weeks. We finished it. We got him back on the show. We finished it, and it was good. I'm glad we finished it because it was good. In fact, I think I liked the back half better than the first half. I'm not sure. I think they're both nice, but I think it wrapped up nicely, so I'm glad we got him back on the show. It's long because we did the two parts, so each part was like 45 minutes, so I'm just going to get pretty quickly into it. But I just wanted to mention here at the top of the show, you know, I have COVID. I have COVID for the third time. That's not actually what I wanted to mention, but that is something. I'm just chilling with COVID. The first two times, it really kicked my ass. Right now, I feel fine, more or less. So hopefully that holds up for the rest of the duration of my time in the apartment. But what I wanted to say is Brave Dave and I are talking about peer support, this concept of peer support and how, you know, people helping people and people helping each other. And I just wanted to mention really quickly at the top of the show here, you know, thank you so much to everyone that has ever subscribed to my Patreon, people who are subscribed currently, people who have subscribed in the past. Thank you to everyone who's ever bought music from me on Bandcamp, on any one of these times I've done the releases on Bandcamp. It's Bandcamp Friday today. If you're listening to this episode on the day that it's being released, Friday, March 3rd, it's Bandcamp Friday. If you're listening to this episode and you would like to contribute to this show in some way and you never have before and you would like to and you have the means to do so, I'll put it out there that I'd love to have your support to help keeping this show going. A big way that I'm able to have this show continue moving forward and continue making the content that I make online and continue to do what I do is through quite literal peer support, peer monetary support, like people who are in my audience, my peers, my friends, helping out and chipping in. And it means everything to me. It is the reason why this thing stays afloat sometimes. So thank you to everyone who's ever contributed. And if you would like to contribute, patreon.com/AustinArcher or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com if you want to get some music for your trouble. Vinyl is on the way to everyone who ordered the vinyl. It's happening, okay? They sent me the test pressings. The masters were off. They weren't working, so they had to remaster the whole thing. I just listened to those and checked those off. So now they are going to press the actual vinyl. It's happening finally. Hopefully those will be out to people soon, and they will be for sale on the Bandcamp site soon. They're not yet, but there's a whole bunch of music over there on Bandcamp if you want to go check that out and participate in some peer support of this show. That's all I wanted to say at the top of the show. Thank you so much for indulging me, and thank you so much for being here week after week. Let's get into it, shall we? From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my friend Brave Dave about peer support. What's up, YouTube? What's up, Spotify? What's up, Apple Podcasts? Wherever you are, not Stitcher. People are always like, are you going to do it on Stitcher? And I'm like, not yet. It's been 4 years and still not yet. So if you're still just like, I need it on Stitcher, I don't know what to tell you. It's on YouTube. You got YouTube. You have YouTube. You might not have Spotify or Apple Podcasts, but you have YouTube. Go watch it on YouTube. We're back with more show. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hi. You know, I'm not great, actually. And
I don't mean to laugh at that answer. I appreciate it. I actually appreciate that you're being straightforward with me and just telling me. That's what we need to do more of.
That's my job, right? I'm as a personality, my job is you say, how are you? I mean, it's everybody's job in public mm-hmm. and in the world. How are you? I'm great. I'm actually dying on the inside a little, but I'm great.
I'm so happy to be here on the podcast. But if you're not doing great and we're talking about mental health and you say I'm doing great and you're not doing great, then what the frig dog are we even doing?
Yeah. I agree. And it, you know? So, and that's the thing. It's like, I'm not diagnosed with depression, but I go through these like depressive episodes, and
sure.
You can still enjoy things, you know, and deal with depression.
Oh yeah.
I think people assume that depression equals just like unhappy all the time. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
happy. And like, as in an instance, I love talking to you. I can't wait to discuss all the things we're going to discuss. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I don't feel that great. And I just, as a kind of like a precursor message, if you're not great, say that shit, man. You know, don't feel there's an obligation to tell people that you're not, or that you are if you're not, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure. My back hurts, and it always hurts, but it hurts especially today, and it's been hurting in different areas that made me worried it's my kidneys or something. I don't know. And then also, like, the year has gotten off to a very slow start with partnerships and money, and it's been like I've been feeling very tight and anxious a lot, and you know, like, just generally uncomfortable on a day-to-day basis. I don't have a lot of just like I'm not like cruising, but I'm also doing a lot of things that on a day-to-day basis that I'm excited to be doing. I'm excited to be here talking to you. I'm always like excited to like be making the next contact on what the next project might be, and this and that. There's always exciting stuff. I'm chit-chatting with friends and family on the phone. It's not all terrible, but yeah, I have had a resting state of discomfort, and this time of year I sort of get that way. What's going on in your life that you think is, if you could pinpoint it, that's making you feel maybe less than stellar?
Right. I think people that do anything in this line of work, whether it's influencing or podcasting or just trying to get a name out there for themselves that maybe aren't one of like the three classic, you know, performative arts, find sure. themselves being their own agent, being their own manager, being their own producer. And then they start to realize, you know, they were all worried that they weren't going to have enough to do. Mm-hmm. So then they're like, I have to network with everybody, even if I don't like them and they don't do anything relevant to me. I have to make sure that I take every opportunity, even if it doesn't pay well. I have to say yes to every gig, because if I don't, then I won't be remembered. So they say yes to all these things. And then they realize, not only do I not want to do half of these things, but they're not creating an environment that I want to be in that's trying to propel me somewhere, you know. And I feel like at this point, like, I have so many things that I've said yes to, or that I just initiated on my own as a solo project, and I just want to scale back and focus on things that are important to me. And that's been kind of my goal, has been deconstructing all of these, just like, I just imagine like all of these like crumbly half built towers and a giant maze around me. And I'm like, which of these am I going to finish already? You know? So that's what we're doing. We're knocking down some half done projects and just focusing on some things that I think in the long run are actually worth doing.
Do you feel like you're kind of mourning the loss of the half done projects that you're knocking down? Or are you sort of like sad to be like, okay, I'm going to have to let that one go? Or is that a relief? How does that feel?
It feels good. I want to do it. It's more like an embarrassment if I've already told people. It's like a chronic thing I do where I feel the need to tell people about projects. I told people I was going to make this comedic coffee table book a year ago. I'm working on it still. I have a lawyer that's helping me copyright the imagery and stuff. And I'm like, why in the hell did I feel the need to tell people that I was going to have that done in a month when I didn't know anything about it? So the things that I'm not doing, it's more in reference to wishing that I just hadn't talked about them, because now it's like, there's like this imagery in my brain that people are like, oh, that's Dave, the half do it guy.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I've got this double vinyl that I've been trying to get out for people for a long time. I've been talking about it for like close to 2 years now of this album. And then I had people actually order it all the way back in like, I think we did the campaign in like July or August, and a bunch of people ordered it so that it could get made. But then the process of actually getting vinyl pressed and manufactured and made, they sent me out the test pressings in January. The test pressings didn't work. So they have to redo the pressing because they were too loud on the top end, and they've got to remaster it and make it better, and then send me out more test pressing. So people are messaging me and being like, hey, are we ever going to get that vinyl that we ordered? Like, is that ever happening? And I'm like, it is. No, like, yes, it is happening. It's just – and there's only so much that I can control. And right. I know that feeling of, and I know that that's like, that's an acute example of like a project that people are actually like, hey, where is that? But then there's other things that I'm just like, I've told people this and that, that I'm trying to get this movie made. And it's been like 4 years now of like trying to get this thing made. And I'm just like, we'll see. I remain committed to bit by bit chipping away at it, but it's one of those big projects, probably like your coffee table book, that just feels like I can't hammer it out in like a week. It's just going to take, like, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there over the course of a long period of time,
and just
continue to return to it. And then in the meantime, you've got all these little projects. Like, it's always easy to just pop on and do a podcast. I can always just go like, yeah, let's schedule out an hour or two to sit down and chat. And then I'll need like an extra hour or two of my time to edit it after this and then get it up, and it'll be out. And that's a thing I can feel like I accomplished and I can feel proud of. And I can say I got out another episode of the podcast. But that's a lot different than trying to make a music video or a short film or a goddamn feature or a book.
Yeah.
Books take a long time.
The more I discovered about books, I realized there are so many different little steps in the process, and none of them are cheap. They were like, hey, you got to make sure that your pages are just like inside the lines, and we can like review it and make sure that your stuff is inside the lines. So it's not a big deal. I was like, oh, that's good. They're like, it's about $2,000. I'm like, what the fuck? It's $2,000 to make sure that I'm inside the lines? I mean, I could do that. And they're like, if you do it, it'll be horrible. I'm like, well, okay. But I guess I won't do that then.
Books are a surprisingly prohibitively expensive venture. So like there's not many forms these days that are super prohibitively expensive. Like the reason why everyone has a podcast is because it's accessible. Like it's a thing where like most people a lot of people who want to start a podcast have access to the internet in some way and maybe could afford $100 microphone from Guitar Center or something that
right.
they can, you know, that records audio well enough that if they wanted to, they could throw together a podcast and put it out there. And there's not a huge barrier to entry. A lot of distribution services charge like between $5 and $10 a month to distribute your audio onto different platforms. Or you could just literally have your own hosting site, like your own website that your podcast is on, whatever, or, you know, making internet content on your phone. If you have a phone that has a camera on it, which a lot of people these days do, you can make internet content. But if you want to make like legit film or release a book, and you wouldn't think books would be this crazy, but it's expensive. And it's a long process involving a lot of people and a lot of conversations and a lot of layers that you got to get through, but from idea to actual thing, which is why anytime someone does manage to publish a book or make a film, I'm always like, hey, regardless of how I feel about it, that's a thing you just did. It's a feat that I'm impressed by.
Right. You know? The fact that you made it a physical copy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like college. Like, I don't know how useful it'll be, but you did it, and that's hard as shit. So good for you.
Yeah. You have a degree. You did it. You did. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of barriers to accomplishing that task.
You know? Speaking of projects, I want to let you know I've front to back to your album several times. It's so good, man. It's so good.
Thank you so much.
It's really so good. And it's so diverse, too. You know, because a lot of indie stuff you kind of get lost in and you're like, am I on track like 4 or 10? I don't even know at this point. But I felt like I was on a journey. I really appreciated it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that feedback. I think that comes from my musical theater background and just from like being a storyteller that like I can't. And also, like, you see this in my content. I get bored if I do the same of one thing too much. And that's why I've never been good at like niching out. People are like, no, you just got to find that niche and then just like grind that thing into the fucking dust. But I'm like, I get my brain for whatever reason is like constantly changing the channel on stuff. But I do like an album where you can't predict what the next song is going to sound like based on the way that the first 3 or 4 songs sound. Like the first 3 or 4 songs on the album are like so sonically different and change up that you go like, I don't know what the next. And I like when I listen to an album by an artist that's like that, where I'm like, I have to listen to the whole thing now because I have to know like what you've done from. But if I listen to the first 4 tracks of an album and they all more or less sound
like variations on the same theme, sometimes my brain will be like, I can bet what the rest of it sounds like. And and I might want to listen to the rest of it just because I might really be into whatever the vibe is. But I don't know. I like when – so I appreciate that you heard that, and I appreciate that feedback.
Oh, yeah. So, absolutely.
Yeah. But I wouldn't know – I wouldn't be able to do it differently if I tried either, because people will be like, I really like the comeback. Why don't you make more songs like that? And I'm like, because I don't – because they come out the way they come out.
Because I already made the comeback.
they come out the way that they come out. So like,
put it on repeat, friend.
Yeah, if I tried to redo the comeback because it's the one that people like more, I don't think it would sound as good. It would sound like I'm trying to capitalize on that sound or something, and then you know, it wouldn't be as. But then again, that's what I think a lot of creators do. With niching out is like they're like I'm gonna just replicate this thing that worked, and it works like algorithmically and with the audience response it seems to work when people are just like, I'm just gonna keep feeding you that sweet cookie that I know you like. Yeah. You know, and
I'm so tired of it, man.
I
know after like the eighth or ninth video, and I've been doing okay, the content will do okay, but after the eighth or ninth video, somebody commented and said, we only want to hear about your kids and why they're upset. And I was like, fuck you, man. That's what I wanted to say. But instead, I was like, well, sorry, mister, but I do lots of other content on here. And I was like, fine, I'll make a video about why the kids are upset. I enjoy the series, but I'm like.
And, it's like, and there are plenty of those. You're like, hey, there's plenty. There's a whole playlist. Go look at them. There's plenty. If that's all you want to hear, that's totally fine. There's plenty. Go, you know.
I guarantee people, you've only seen half of them anyway. So,
yeah, when I do like a Bandcamp exclusive release on like for music, like of just my TikTok songs, people will always be like, "Will you please put these on Spotify?" And I'm like, "No, because there's specific music that I want attached to my artist name on Spotify and on like those more public facing free platforms, and B, no, because like." This is a money-making venture. This is like a fundraising thing, and it's like a Patreon thing. It's like, if you want these songs, they're available on my Bandcamp. And also, there are lots of free songs available on Spotify and Apple Music if you want. Like, there's no shortage. There's enough for you to go and peruse. But if you really want these TikTok songs, and that's the song you want to listen to in your car, you can get it on Bandcamp. You can even stream for free from Bandcamp. Like you can, you know, if you want to. But it's just when people are like,
if you want to be that guy.
Yeah. Why don't you make more of the, you know, it's like, there is enough of that. And where people, I miss when you used to do this. Okay. Well, all right.
Yeah. You know, my favorite song you've ever done is Normal and Human. And, I feel like it's one of a kind, and I'm like, man, I wish there was some other stuff that was like Normal and Human. I'm like, there's Normal and Human. And I go and listen to it and I'm like, all right, that had just scratched. I'll go listen to some other stuff now.
Yeah. Thank you. I like that song too. And again, so my, and you probably feel the same way about like your favorite videos or about like your favorite pieces of music that you've made. I think that the times that I'm most satisfied with a song is something that just sort of like arrives on its own without much cajoling or like or hand wringing. It just sort of one day is there, and that was one of those songs, Normal and Human. I think I was in a pocket for a while there when I was writing songs specifically for the internet, and they were really coming out nicely. Lately, I've felt whenever I sit down to write an internet song that I'm really forcing it, because it's like, well, I haven't written an internet song in a while, so I've got to do something. And I'm like, ooh, I'll do a song about this kind of relatable topic. But while I'm writing it, I can feel myself sort of just like jamming the pieces together and like making this puzzle work and being like, just fit, you know? And
I've come this far.
Yeah. And Normal and Human was one of those songs that was just there one day. And I can't really explain it. So when it's like, try to replicate that, try to do more of that, I'm like, well, I would love to. And I'll be happy to. And I'm sure I will at some point. I'm sure there will be another song that's more in that vein of songwriting. I have written several songs that are in that same sort of like standard folk structure.
Right.
You know, format, but like they come when they come, they happen when they happen, and they're best when I'm not trying to force them. And I don't really get to control how that happens. Do you feel like you experience creativity that way?
I do. And I find I do like the musical parody stuff, and it's the closest relation to, you know, what you do that I can share, but it's like, I'll write out stuff and I'll be like, I can already tell when it's going to be garbage by the end. Cause I'm like, what do people relate to? What's on the same vibe as everybody else? And I'm like, when we all do this, and I'm like, I'm going to write a whole song about that shit. And then I'll like scrape it out for like 2 days. And I finally give up and I start going on rhymezone.com trying to find ways to make this work. And it's still not working. And I'm like, finally, I'm like, you know what? The whole thing's pieced together. There we go. And I'll set up the lighting and I'll record and I edit it all in and I finish. And then I watch it front to back. And I'm like, this is horrible. And I'm not going to post it. And I've had whole productions that have gone from start to finish after a week that I was like, so like, just like manically brainwashed that I had to do it. Because it was an idea that I saw somebody else succeed. Like I saw somebody else talk about road rage and I'm like, I'm going to write a song about it. And then I get to the end and I'm like, I can tell that I pulled from nothing. You know what I mean? I don't like it now.
the idea didn't really possess you. You sort of forced the idea to, you were like, no, we're doing this. And the idea wasn't something that just came in and like sort of took over. And you were like, well, I'm doing this now. And it doesn't even really feel like I'm doing it. It's sort of like flowing out of me through me. Instead, you're like, no, I had this idea watching a video and now I'm forcing it to happen because I need content and yeah. I need something new to put out. And there really is a difference between being possessed by an idea and sort of like grabbing an idea and forcing it to happen and forcing it to be a thing.
You know? And the idea can be good. You know, I've had lots of like, I make a lot of videos for myself, but also for the company I work for. And I'll think of like maybe like a transition or something, just something where I'm like, this song would be really cool if there was somebody like the back of somebody's head and then it cut off into darkness. And then like that, like little vision I had that I know would be awesome. I'm like, I'm just going to Frankenstein some shit together because I want that particular vision to occur. So something that could have been really cool and organic and I like saw it and it was all there, instead of waiting for the rest of it to grow off of it, I'm like, we got to get in the studio right now and like just cram that shit in there. And it's like, what could have been cool? Everyone's like, and the feedback's always the same. I like what you're trying to do, but I don't understand why you felt the need to do it this way. And I don't either. I'm like, you know what? I should have just let it grow. But instead I got so excited about the concept that I had that I just scraped it out, you know, something together. So I've been trying to avoid that. I'm getting better about like a thought book where I write down the concept and then leave like, you know, three paragraphs top and bottom below it. Like, let's just see what comes from it.
Well, and I'm, you know, and sometimes too, even I do go hard on something like that where I'm like, no, I have to do it now. But that's because I am feeling that sort of like creative muse ooze, like I'm in it and I'm like, oh no, it's happening right now, and if I don't do it now I might lose it. And so sometimes it is that like I've got a tiger by the tail thing, or I've got a, you know, where it's like I got to do it now. But it happens both ways, where sometimes it's like, again, being sort of possessed, being like, well, I'm gonna work this juice until it stops flowing through me and I'm gonna see what all comes out. And then sometimes it's like, I'm gonna just force this because I need something new to post. And that's where I think that what you were talking about at the beginning of like just going out on your own as a creator and as a creative person and trying to make a living through creative ventures, and in a world where we are competing with and taking marching orders from an algorithm that is outside of anyone's control or understanding or comprehension, and we're just like, I'm dying if I'm not creating new stuff. Like I'm losing relevancy every day that I'm not posting something new or adding something new to the conversation. So a lot of it isn't the most inspired or the best, you know? And I think it's sort of like what happens to like you know, a show like Saturday Night Live or something, people will always go like, oh, Saturday Night Live's really dropped off in quality. And it's like, no, if you actually go through the years of how long it's been on TV, the nature of the show is they're writing like 15 to 20 original sketches every week for live television. And they're doing that every week for like 20 weeks a year. And just the nature of the show is that like each season is going to have like 6 to 7 standout sketches. And that's it, you know, right. And like, that's just how it's been. And it's been like that always. And then you watch like the best sketches from certain seasons from, you know, years past. And you think like, oh, it was better back then. It was a better show back then. It's like, no, that cast with those people that you liked, they also had really crappy sketches, really just like unfunny, you know, but that's because the nature of their job is like, we have no choice but to write new material every week. Yeah. And from that pressure cooker comes some really brilliant things, some really great little nuggets. And sometimes it's just something as weird and random as like David Pumpkins, where it's like, hey, I don't have anything. Let's just get weird. Let's just get goofy with it. But also what comes from that is a lot of just like subpar, you know, writing and material. And like, that's what's naturally going to happen. You know,
right
on a show. And there's going to be a lot of recycling of formula and format where it's like, let's just plug in a new joke to the same format because there's no time. We got to film the show.
You know, there's a lot of comparison there too, right? If you go back, if you pull like an SNL highlight DVD series, right, you're going to have a lot of Eddie Murphy. You're going to have a lot of Chris Farley and Dana Carvey. Because those people were very good at what they did, and half of their sketches are garbage. They are hilarious. And I think people try to, there's like a Gary V thing that occurred whenever he started making content. Right. And Gary V, I have no problem with him. I love Gary V. I love some of the stuff he has to say. I know that's probably a hot take for people that are much bigger brain than I am, but I like Gary V.
I think
the problem is that I feel like it's instilled this like necessity to be great now. Because people assume that you have to be an entrepreneur right now. Your big idea has to be right now. You know, early retirement, the FIRE method. There's all these things that tell you that you need to be manifesting yourself right now. As if it's somehow a sin to just coast along until your big thing happens, you know, because that's a correlation to just rotting until you're not here. And I don't think that's true, but it's just the zeitgeist now where it's like, I have to be building an enterprise. I mean, I got sucked into it. The whole Brave Dave thing, this book I'm trying to do, the stuff I'm doing now, you know, apart from White Flag, which we'll talk about later, but a majority of the social stuff I'm doing now started after I started making money. I'm like, this will be the empire that I have that, you know, everyone else already has. They're doing real estate. I'll do TikTok.
Yep.
It's just not necessary.
Well, and I think that's probably with what we talked about at the beginning of the episode, where that feeling of like discomfort and dying on the inside comes from is like, you think you finally found this thing where you're like, oh, this is how I'm going to make it. This is my way. And it's suited for me and it's suited for my skill set and my sensibility. And then you kind of get that thing that you've been hunting for, the ability to like make money on your own terms, doing something that you feel like you have control over. And initially it's very exciting and awesome. And I still will say like, I'd rather have this job than a lot of other jobs I could have right now.
Absolutely. You know,
if I have to make money doing something, I would rather it be doing this than many, many other things. But once you start getting into just the daily in and out of doing this as a job, you really are like, oh, geez, it can be just a grueling, and it can really take away what I love about this thing when it becomes just something I have to do to pay my bills and to make money, when I just have to come up with a new idea when I'm working for a company or a brand and I'm writing ad copy for them, and I just always have to have a new concept. I always have to have a new way to sell this thing. And I've already given them 60 different scripts of how to sell this thing. And I've always got to have a new one.
Yeah,
it is. It's like, how many different ways can I do this? And you start going like, well, I'm just going to start grabbing trending sounds from other people. And you start getting just like, they can't all be my magnum opus or my masterpiece. Sometimes I do just have to put out content because that's my job. And then you start feeling a little bit like, am I even an artist anymore? Am I even like I used to have like integrity as an artist.
Right.
I used to like only make things if I thought they were worth making. And now I just make things all the time because it's my job to be making things all the time, you know? And that's, you know, but that you, I heard about this before I had this as my job. I heard people who had the job that I wanted talking about how like, it's not everything you think it's going to be. Like, you're going to find ways to be unfulfilled and unhappy in that job too, you know.
Don't worry, we're creative enough to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So we're sort of engaging right now, you and I, at the top of this show. We're sort of engaging in what I think the topic is, which I think what we're doing right now, correct me if I'm wrong, is a form of peer support. Correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you and I have both experienced AA. And mm-hmm. pretty much similar ways. I loved your take, by the way. I heard your take recently on AA and how you feel about it. And I liked that a lot.
Which one was that? What did I say?
who were you talking to? It was that lovely Irish woman who had many great things to say.
Yeah, Louise Carroll.
About how AA makes people feel a certain way when in reality, not everyone may fit the stature of AA. You know, when people think peer support, they think big circle, chairs, coffee, sometimes cigarettes, empty feelings.
Sure.
But peer support is literally just utilizing other people around you for support in shared experiences. And people do it every day. People do it with their family. When you call your sister to explain how horrible your day has been and how Rob is a shitty guy, that's peer support. Maybe not the most effective peer support, but it is absolutely peer support, and people don't realize that. That has been something I've been focusing on, mental health in general, especially peer support, has just been a major focus. It's one of the towers I'm not knocking down, but building up, is realizing that mental health is important, and we talk about it on social media, but not in the way that I want to. So I'm trying to flip the script a little bit on how we focus on it. Primarily through peer support.
What do you think currently is lacking in the way that we're talking about mental health on social media and the conversations that we're having over there? What are you not seeing that you would like to see more of?
So you only have two options when you talk about mental health on social media. You have three options. Your first is to be a mental health professional and have bountiful knowledge that you can recite in 1,000 different ways and provide insightful information every single day. If that's your case, you're not an influencer. You're a mental health professional that's on social media. Good for you. Your other option, as a mental health influencer that has whatever degree of education or experience you have, is to provide information at whatever pace you want to provide it at. Typically a very fast pace, because we feel like we have to push out content all the time until you have no more new information to provide. And you as a resource, I don't want to say used up, but you as a resource have provided all the information that you had to provide. And then you stop and you're done. Your third option is to provide the same information over and over and over. The fourth option that I didn't provide is make shit up, because I don't want that should never be an option for anyone. But if you run out of things to say, you just say, well, I guess it could be about depression. Yeah, sure. Why not? You know what I mean? That's your other option. And I feel that I love how much information is being shared about mental health and all the support that's being given on social media. But eventually, the well for everyone is going to tap dry. And what you do from there will determine whether or not social media hurts or helps mental health. Peer support does not require endless data and information. It does not require you to tell the truth about whether or not something is actually a sign that you have, you know, dissociative identity disorder. It requires you to be truthful with another person and to be open and honest about each other, about how you feel, you know, so you can have that shared experience. That's why I think it's important. And that's why I have concerns about the mental health field in general. Again, I think the people that do that will dwindle away. I think the ones that will end up being left are the people that, again, either have the endless bountiful knowledge, are willing to kind of share the core principles over and over, which is totally fine because not everybody sees the content all the time. And then the people that focus less on trying to educate and more trying to provide that support. I'm not an educator and I get bored easily. So my focus is to let people know about things that they can do to help each other just by themselves. That's what my content is about, is my own shared experience helps you feel less crazy. And that's what it was all about after I did mental health and parenting mental health on social media, was all the messages were, you are like me and that makes me feel good and not hate my life. And I was like, I don't have to go take a workshop. That's enough for me to know that that is effective in that way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that, I think that's like the foundation of peer support. Like that's where it always starts, is just like, and I talked about this a few episodes ago too, where it was just me and I was telling sort of my story of like my first AA meeting that I ever went to, because the woman who 12-stepped me and got me in the rooms popped into the live stream and was commenting, and I was like, oh my God, you know, Hannah's here. And so I was talking about my story with Hannah, but I think that it starts with just hearing someone else tell your story and being like, oh, okay. So right off the bat, that story that I thought was like so unique and so hard to grasp and complex and hard to treat because it was so multifaceted has occurred in other people. In fact, it's actually pretty common. In fact, there's actually a lot of people who have many elements of their personal story that mirror my own. And I think that's sort of where it starts, is that identification. And that's really powerful. And I think that's what I do on online too, is like, I just try to be like, I have panic disorder and I have panic attacks. And like, you know, and then people are like, oh, you have panic attacks? You don't seem like a person that would have panic attacks. I'm like, oh, all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does a person who has panic attacks seem like? What do they look like? What do they sound like? Because I know, sure, there are some people that seem really reclusive and really introverted and have a hard time expressing themselves outwardly, or maybe have a hard time in social situations and are very quiet. And you think that's what a person who has panic attacks looks like. They wear it. And it's like, yeah, sometimes. But sometimes I can't tell you how many very confident, talented performers, people who work in front of audiences regularly, I've met who are like, no, I struggle greatly with panic attacks. You know, and it's like, and it affects all kinds of people. It's and it doesn't really look like any one specific thing. You know, I have videos of like, I have video footage that's out there on the internet of me having a panic attack, and you wouldn't know it by looking at the video. But just telling people that initially, that ability to, for someone to hear you and go, that's me, is really powerful. And then you can build from there on like, let's tell each other now I trust you to tell you my more details of my story, and let's talk and let's be honest and let's see if there's more ways that we relate. And if we relate on our problems, maybe a solution that's worked for you would work for me as well.
Yeah. And that you don't need any expertise except on yourself. You know, right. That's the beauty of it. Not to have like a Me Too thing, but a couple days ago, I was working on my computer. I was not in a good mood anyway. And then I just kind of froze. And it was like seeing the Matrix, but shitty. Every problem that existed in my life just became one wall of visual data, where I was like, I see everything that's wrong right now, and I'm freaking out. And like my chest hurt, and my body was like buzzing, and I was getting a headache, and I felt weird, and I like couldn't breathe properly. And I was like, is this a panic attack? I've never had one of these before. And so I sent a message to my friend who has them. And I was like, I think I'm having a panic attack. And I was like, what do those feel like? And he said, I'm not going to tell you. He's like, I'm going to tell you what helps me to calm down. He said, I'm not going to tell you what a panic attack feels like. And then provide you with the symptoms that you will then look for if you actually are or aren't. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This is what I think you should do to help yourself. And it helped. What I could have done is gone on social media and said 5 ways to know if you're having a panic attack. And it could have said things like, you know, do your toes feel funny? And I would have been like, yeah, probably. I think so. Oh my God. Yeah. But I just went to a peer and it helped far more than me trying to seek out what I wanted to know. You know, I just wanted someone else who could possibly know what it feels like. I didn't need somebody to tell me if I was feeling that way. And that was so simple, so helpful. And it was a one-step process, you know? So it was very helpful.
It's a really good way of describing it. I haven't heard it described that way before, to be honest. Because as soon as you said that, I was like, you know what? That actually resonates with me. And I've never thought of it like that. But I'll have these moments throughout the day where I get like a jolt of a download of all of the things that I'm concerned about in that moment where I'm like, and it starts like, there's like small things. There's like, you know, just like emails that I haven't responded to or like people that I need to touch base with or projects that I need to button up that I'm coming up on a deadline up against or people just that I need to respond to. And then like, it gets bigger to the extent of like something in my health that like my eye's been twitching for like a week and like, everything I look everything I look at online is like, it's fine. Eyes will twitch sometimes for up to like several weeks. And like, if your eye is working and you're not having a hard time opening your eye, you're fine. And I'm just kind of like, okay, or I have a tumor pressing on my optic nerve, or, you know, and it's like all these things at once, almost in, and it's like almost this download of information that happens in a matter of seconds. All of these thoughts at once come in and it's very overwhelming. And this will happen to me several times a day where like, I'll just sort of like be sitting, minding my own business or going about something. And then I'll be like, oh, I kind of feel, especially if I'm like, I kind of feel okay today. I kind of feel all right. And then all of a sudden they'll be like,
why
do you, they'll be like, what about all this stuff? Yeah. And it will happen. And the way that you explained it there were like, it's like seeing the matrix and getting the data report or the download of like, here's all the things that you are currently concerned about and all of them all at once and take a look at that. And it's like, and then I can only handle that for so long before I have to, find a way to distract my brain. I can't stay in that space. It's too much. Right. And I have to find a way to be like, it's okay. It's okay.
It's great. It's fine.
Yeah. I've always had that many things that I'm worried about, pretty much always. And I'm always okay.
It's had a wider field of view. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just let's just focus on the next thing. What's the next thing? What's the next thing I can do? You know? And if the next thing is a little nap, I'll take a little nap.
Yeah. Yep.
That works, you know? Yeah, it is nice. It's nice to hear that you're not alone. I'm interested in this thing that you said, the fourth thing. You said the 3 ways that mental health is discussed online. And you said the fourth thing is people who kind of like, just they make stuff up or they'll kind of go like, I guess that's depression. I wonder what you think about when people, do you think it's useful when people sort of like shoehorn in a mental health diagnosis into a thing that like, it's like, that's not necessarily, it could be, but like, I'll give you a specific example and you maybe have seen this video. You probably actually did knowing what you specifically talk about online. Did you see this video going around of the woman who is crying, very, very upset? And the caption on the screen is, when you just broke up with your long-term boyfriend and you have ADHD. And then in parentheses, it says ADHD makes emotions very intense. And the person's crying. Did you see this video?
I did not. But it sounds like it should have come across my page. It's
yeah. Well, anyway,
I get that all the time.
And it's a thing where I'm like, I don't want to shit on this person's very real emotional experience that they're having. And also I like rejection sensitivity. We talked about this the last time you were on the podcast. Like we, you know, like rejection sensitivity and also just like having heightened emotional responses to things absolutely can be attached to various forms of neurodivergency. But in this one instance, it was like someone was explaining something. The caption on screen is like, a very sad thing happened. I ended a very long relationship and I'm very sad about it. And she was sad. But it's like, I'm sad because I have ADHD. And so people were stitching it and being like when your whole family dies in a plane crash, but you don't have ADHD. And so it's like, oh, well, bummer. That's too bad.
Oh, God, no. You know,
because it's like, well, of course you're sad. Of course you're crying, you know. And it's sort of someone being like, I think I can make this about ADHD, this topic. And it's like, yeah, but also like, I think people who don't have that mental health diagnosis also cry when they go through a breakup. I think that that's normal. I think that that's, right. You know what I mean? And so it's like, I don't want to invalidate the experience that this person was having or say that her neurodivergencies or mental health diagnoses could not have exacerbated her experience.
I agree with you.
You know, it's like you're sort yes. of like forcing, like maybe she has a niche where she talks about ADHD a lot, but then she's experiencing something and then it's like, I can make this about that too. And it's like, you can, or you can just let that be a moment in your life where it's like, yeah, I was very upset today because of a very, for a very obvious reason, you know? For a reason that most people would be upset about, you know? Right. And at that point, it's like, is it a neurodivergent response to cry about ending a long relationship?
Like, I have an opinion. I'm a hot mess today, man. Not even going to lie. My phone is about to die. So I'm going to just disable this rig that makes me sound better for your podcast and talk to you on my phone because that's the kind of day it is, Austin.
I love it.
We're being real here.
We're being real. We're running with it. I love it. And I'll hear your opinion shortly.
So this is obviously where we experienced our technical difficulties and Dave had to run and we were not able to get him back that day, but we were able to get back together yesterday for the epic conclusion of our conversation. And that is what I will play for you now. And we're back. It's episode 2 of my conversation with Brave Dave. It's like we never left. It's only been what has it been? 2 weeks since we did the first part of it. So it's just like we blinked and we're back.
Exactly right. I used to have a general understanding of time, but like my timetables are so smashed together anymore that it really does feel like I was on here a few days ago for me. So
yeah, it does actually for me too. Even though there's a whole lifetime of stuff that happened between then and now, I was sick all last week with a cold that I was testing for COVID and was not COVID. And then this week I went to my therapist's office and she told me that she was getting over something too. And I was like, oh, I'm getting over something. And I was like, everyone's getting over something. And then the next day she texted me and she was like, actually, I have COVID. I tested positive for COVID. And so I went and tested and I have COVID. So
first time?
This was the third time.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. This is the third time. The first two times were really rough. Really, really bad. Like I got really, really sick. Not so sick that I was like hospitalized, but like I wasn't having a good time. Yeah. I was sick properly. But this time it's day 3 and I'm like, I feel fine. I feel like I was sick all last week and I feel like I'm like getting over that still. But last week it wasn't testing positive for COVID. So maybe that was it. And it just what I was getting false negatives. I don't know. But I'm home while I'm testing positive. And, you know, I've got like my voice has a lower register, which I always like.
That's my favorite thing. It's like, all right, well, this is the time that we're going to do some real serious recording before I go back to.
I'm going to really lean into the fact that. There's a nice low growl going on with my voice. Okay, we're back. We were talking about peer support.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got the new podcast coming out, White Flag. What I wanted to ask you, I think that we were getting into as we were interrupted the last time, is like, what are some situations in your life where peer support has been useful for you?
So I'm an alcoholic, and you have experience with AA and being around other alcoholics. So yeah. You know, the kind of person that an alcoholic typically is. We have a lot of the same characteristics typically. Mm-hmm. And one thing we're really good at is not getting into trouble when like a bunch of people are watching us, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's that whole thing, you know, we're very good at, you know, being a chameleon and fitting in and not doing things we shouldn't do, or at least when we're sober enough to not do things we shouldn't do. But for me, especially during recovery and now, you know, everyone's like, what, are you okay if we like go out clubbing? And I'm like, are you going to drink while we're out clubbing? I'm like, probably not. I didn't like drinking while clubbing anyway. So that was never an issue. The issue for me is when I'm like at a hotel on a work trip and there's no one in the room, but the room service delivers, you know, wine, liquor, and spirits. And my brain just says, no one would ever know, you know?
100%. That's exactly how everyone, that exact experience. Everyone always asks me when I go out with people, are you going to be okay? If we order drinks, are you going to be okay? And I'm like, yeah, the last thing I want to do is relapse in front of like a group of people. Like,
that would be really awkward.
Yeah. Like in front of all of my friends who know I'm sober, I'm just going to be like, tonight's the night. And everyone's just going to watch me be like, oh, should we do something? Should we intervene? Right. Yeah. It's 100%. When I'm by myself at a place that, you know, I'm at a work event with an open bar and no one there knows me. That's a scary situation. Or really, I don't even want to do it in front of people I don't know. 100% like by myself is more scary.
During those times, you know, I am not a particularly lonely person. I have a network of people that I talk to. You know, I have people that I could reach out to for support that aren't overly gushy about it or overly judgmental, that would be receptive to anything. I've done a very good job building this little network of ex-addicts and people involved in mental health and people that, you know, have my same profession. I really don't have a lack of empathy in my life. But when you are alone and you experience these things, there is a great distance between you and talking to somebody. And that's what I think. I just had somebody close to me try to take their life. And the first thing that somebody tries to say in that situation is, you should have reached out. You could have, you know, I would have been there for you in a heartbeat. It doesn't matter. You know, in those kind of states of being, you aren't thinking about how convenient it is to contact somebody.
Right.
So, you know, I'm kind of in the same space where it's like, when I get, you know, stuck in those modes alone, I'm like, my brain even knows, I know I can talk to somebody. But I don't wanna. I do, but my brain tells me that I don't wanna. So those are the moments when the more you do it and the habit builds, you say, all you gotta do is just take the first step to talk to somebody, and then the rest will kind of, you know, streamline itself. So getting over that first hump by repeatedly using peer support to kind of prove to my own brain that it's helpful during alone times is when it's been the most useful to me.
Yeah. We do talk about that in AA a lot, about just picking up the phone, that's like, that's often the kind of simple thing that we return to, is like, just call somebody else, you know? But it's sort of also why, like, you know, when I'm working with newcomers or trying to make an effort to work with newcomers, I know better than to tell a newcomer to call me. I know better than to do that. Like, I know better than to like tell someone who's like really, really struggling, who like, it's all they could do to get to a meeting. Like, I know how difficult it is to get their ass in that room and be there and be like announcing themselves as an alcoholic who has 2 or 3 days sober or 1 day sober. If I go up to that person and give them my phone number and say, hey, give me a call tomorrow, there's like a 0% chance that they're going to call me. But if I, as the person who has more experience with this peer support model, and knows that this works not only for them, but for me, it also works for me to be working with them. If I say, hey, can I get your phone number? And then they give me their phone number and I say, hey, I'm going to call you tomorrow. You should answer when I call. And then I just take the, as the person who's like in a more, and I might not be like, I think that I can see where my mental health is at based on like how easy or hard it is for me to punch in a number, you know?
Yeah.
And to make a call.
You're right. You do drill it in though, you know, yeah. And that's my sponsor. I remember I went going in cause you don't know the rules. So I went going in, I was like, well, I just generally get along with women better than men.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that I'm the first alcoholic to ever say that. you know, I'm like, I just get along with women better. So I'll probably get like a, you know, like an older woman sponsor that can like, you know, just have like that loving aunt role.
Yeah.
Don't work like that. Instead I got, the super crazy loud guy. And I was like, oh my God, he is like really into this thing. Like way more than, you know, like this is more than a hobby for him.
Yeah.
I got to steer clear of him on my way out of here. And, it didn't happen. Afterwards, he came up to me and he said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And I was like, okay. All right. No. And that's exactly what I needed. And he ended up being somebody so close to me. And, you know, I care for him very deeply now, but, that's what that takes. You know, sometimes peer support takes a little bit of assertiveness from people to say, I am here now. It's a, you know, it's a nice, it would behoove you to answer the phone when I call you tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. my early days, I was getting phone calls 2 or 3 or 4 times a day from strangers, people who I had just met, and they were calling me just to say, how you doing today, Austin? Like, what's going on? You know? And it blew my mind. I'd never experienced anything like that before. I'd never had such instant support and instant community. But I didn't really understand it at the time, but like those people were also doing that for themselves. They were like, well, this is how I stay connected to this thing. This is how I stay connected to this solution. So I think that's an interesting aspect of peer support that it's not just about, you know, going out of your way to like make sure other people are okay, but it's how we stay okay together, how we stay healthy together. The like me working with you, calling you to check in on you helps me get outside of myself, helps me be rooted in service. And then I, as a result of that, feel better about my life because I feel like I'm not wallowing in my self driven narrative. And, you know, I've spent at least a little portion of my day, you know, asking questions about what's going on in someone else's life. But yeah, like you say with your friend, who I'm sorry that you went through that, your friend that almost died recently. People in that state, often the phone is 1,000 pounds and, you know, it's the last thing you want to do and is pick up the phone and call someone and say, hey, I'm really, really struggling here. I'm really, really close to the edge here, you know? And I mean, sometimes depression, I feel like, can be almost like an intoxicant in and of itself, where, right, you know, you're getting high off of like this shame drug and this like this self-flagellation and this self-hatred. And like the last thing you want to do is to have someone come and take it from you. The isolation gives you permission almost in a way to indulge in the thing. It's sort of like what you were talking about, how like it's a more scary situation to be alone than to be in a group of people, as far as relapse is concerned.
Right. And I love the point you made about kind of exploring peer support in the way that you currently don't do it. And that's, of all the stigmas of peer support, I think that one is probably the hardest to convince the rest of the world of, is that you're either an A person or you're a B person. You're either always asking for the peer support or you're always giving it because you feel like, you know, I'm a B person where I love giving advice to people. And I'm to the point now, it's not an ego thing. It's not, but you feel like I don't want anyone else's advice because they don't understand enough to give me the advice that I need. I'm well adjusted in my own self to know what does and doesn't work, that any suggestion you would have wouldn't be good enough for me to hear it because I've already gone through all the possible scenarios in my head, and that was what it was going in. I was like, I will go to AA because I don't like who I am. And that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what they do in the movies. And when I got over that and realized that I could ask for help in those scenarios, and then subsequently all the other instances of peer support in my life where I was asking for help, and I was like, you know what? Other people get it. Sometimes it takes the physical evidence of people getting it to feel comfortable enough to ask. To be someone that typically is, only outputting to, or only inputting to allow the output to happen. And also people that feel like all they do is ask for help and they're like, well, I can't help anybody. I can barely help myself. Like, that's totally incorrect. You are taking half of the pill here. The satisfaction of providing people your story and your life experience will help you. You can't help it, but let it change who you are as a person. And in turn, hearing that experience from you is going to help someone. May not help person A or B, but it may be the reason that person C gets sober or, doesn't take their own life or decides to get on the right track and, do whatever it is that they're trying to do because of what you said. And that's what we told people. It's like, whether you're one day sober or one day clean or whatever, your one day is better, not better, but more significant to someone that has none. And that is your story that you walk through the front door. So opening up the two-way street is important.
It's so interesting to hear you break it down in that A or B way. Cause instantly my brain goes like, well, which one am I? Which one am I? Which one am I? And I think it's in so many ways, I think I'm like you. I think I'm a B person where especially my outward facing, my public facing persona is like, I do this podcast and I do this content where I'm very, very vocal with an unseen audience about my ideas on how you can better show up in the world for the people around you. Like, here's a better way to be an ally. Here's a better way to be an advocate. Here's a better way to advocate for your own mental health. Like stuff like this. I'm very open with suggestions and with bringing in ideas from my personal lived experience in a very public way. But also I feel like when I'm engaging with my fellows in AA or my friends in real life, I feel like I'm constantly being a taker, where I'm like constantly like going to people with my problems and being like, tell me what I should do. Tell me what I should do about this situation in my dating life. Tell me what I should do about this situation in my professional life. But then also layered in there is, once they tell me what I should do, there's a little voice in the back of my head that's like, nah, you don't know. like, thanks for telling me, but like, you don't know. Like,
I gave it the college try and you gave the answer I thought you were going to give. So never mind.
So like, right. I don't know which version of those things I am, but I do know that I have the ability to convince myself that at least in a context of AA or certain situations, like financial advice or relationship advice one-to-one on a person-to-person basis, I know I have the ability to convince myself that I'm completely unqualified and have nothing to offer. And so I will not open up or share or relay my experience because this is a way that I think my depression and my alcoholism and my disease works on me, is it tells me like, you're so caught up in your own narrative and your own thing that you've lost whatever it was that you once had to offer to people. So it keeps me separated from that peer support process and network. Like, I recently began a 30 and 30, which is a thing that AA people sometimes do. Sometimes they call it a 90 and 90 if they want to be really hardcore, where you go to 90 meetings in 90 days or 30 meetings in 30 days. And I'm in the middle of that process. I'm on like day 14 right now, day 15 today.
How's that going?
It's okay. You know, it's I can't remember the last time I went to 15 meetings in 15 days. It's been kind of like a toxic shock to, or you know, I don't know, not toxic shock. What's it called when you dump a bunch of chlorine in a pool? I think they just call it shocking.
It's shocking. Yeah.
Yeah. Just shocking the pool. It's kind of like that. It's like you got to like jumpstart the car every once in a while. But I was at this meeting the other day. My sponsor had told me, he was like, don't just go to meetings. Like, make sure you're sharing. Make sure you're telling people where you're at and make sure you're getting phone numbers of newcomers and like make sure you're like actively participating, picking up service commitments, all that kind of stuff. I'm at this meeting the other day and it was a round robin share meeting. So I was like, well, whether or not I want to share, I'm going to share in this meeting. They're going to get to me. Someone's going to call on me and I'm going to have to share. So I'm like in my head thinking like, what are you going to say today that's going to be helpful? What are you going to say today that's going to be useful to this meeting? And I like couldn't, I just was like, I don't know. I don't have anything right now. I don't have good recovery going on right now. I don't have anything decent to share. And then the thought came into my head. It was like, so say that. So be honest. Yeah. Like, be honest. Like, say what's going on. Say why you're doing a 30 and 30. Explain how you feel like you've lost touch with working a solid everyday program. Explain how you feel like you've lost conscious contact with a higher power or whatever that is to whoever it is in the room. Be honest. So I did that, and it turned out that that day, that was maybe the most useful thing I could have done for that room, because the rest of the shares for the rest of the day were people who were commenting on my share going like, I'm just so happy that you said that. I needed to hear that, that like it's okay to like
not have a zinger for the day.
Yeah. Yeah, or to fall out of touch with your program, you know, or to feel like you're not doing everything that you should be doing for your mental or spiritual health, you know, like it's okay to start over, you know,
right.
To just come back to the basics. I have this problem of thinking that my problems are too complex for simple solutions always. I always think I hate it. I hate it when people tell me drink more water or go on a walk or, you know, watch what you're eating or, you know, I just like, oh, fuck you. It's not that simple. And then the second I do something like that, I'm like, damn it. And I hate.
I feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, you know, so when people say go to more meetings, you know, get your hand up and talk. I'm like, oh, how's that? What's that going to do? Just showing up to a room and just saying, hi, I'm not doing so hot right now. That's going to make me better. And it's like, then I go do it. And it's like, yeah, that kind of helped.
Whatever. I guess it helped. It helped. Okay.
Yeah.
I love everything about what you said, because I feel like I resonate a lot with that, especially, you know, doing AA. And I know your viewers, you probably don't have a huge viewer base in AA, so I won't try and talk about it too much, but it is this feeling of, you know, it's a hard habit to break, because for those of you that don't know, basically you're going in a circle and you're sharing things about your story. And the goal is that whatever you say that day, when other people hear you talk about yourself, something you say resonates with somebody else in the group, which helps them heal.
Right.
So when you first get into the program, there's a lot of ego involved and there's a lot of like insecurity, because you want to make sure that you're contributing like everybody else. So there's a lot of times where it's like, remember as a kid, you would count how many paragraphs in school until it was your turn to read aloud. Well, you do the same thing as adults. You're like, all right, well, they're talking about this subject and he just talked about that subject. So this is the paragraph that I've come up with that I'm going to say to the group, and they're going to love this one. This is a really good one. I like this one today. And yep. Then, you know, there are days when you don't think of that. And that's a really hard habit to break, because you feel like you have to win. Or at least succeed in some way for the day, you know, with the group. So I really appreciate hearing that as well, because, you know, it's this thing about appearances. And that's the reason that I really appreciate what White Flag is doing, is because it's anonymous. Appearances and our self-image and the image that we project to others. I feel the same way about trying to be vulnerable with my audience. I can be vulnerable about things that I've already solved, but I can't say, you know, I yelled at my kids today and I don't know why, And I just have not been very happy recently because my job is to make sure that other parents feel like they can do it. You know what I mean? So it's like this career thing where, you know, you can't seem like you're too bad of a parent or otherwise people won't want to take your parenting advice. You can't seem like you are too bad off with your mental health or obviously your mental health advice was shit. Because it's not working for you, even though I never take my own advice. That's the reason I give it to you all. Don't be like me.
Yeah.
You know, and appearances, you know, in your own life, I have to make sure that I'm, you know, a strong pillar in my family. I have to make sure that, you know, I'm consistent with my friends and don't be a bad friend. And then on the app, you're nobody, not a nobody. You are just no one. Everyone else is as well. It's the same principle with AA, except you can't even see their face. And I think that helps me with, because I use the app from time to time, and I find that I have more success taking advice there because I don't have anyone to judge. You know, it's just the background in which they put it. You know, I have ADHD and I'm a parent, so we have compatibility, but I know nothing else about them. So their advice could be 10 times better or 10 times worse than mine ever was. And I think stripping down those appearances for myself and for the people that are giving it to me makes the two-way street a lot less busy, you know, because that is something I deal with is just appearances all around, inward and outward.
I do think, you know, that's a really good argument for anonymity and like the usefulness of anonymity as a tool. Cause sometimes I struggle with, the anonymous part of AA too, like where I'm just sort of like, what are we doing here? What is this whole, because I'm like, I feel like this tradition started at a time when it was like, oh, you could lose your job if it got out into the community that you have a problem with alcoholism. Whereas today it's like, if my job found out that I was like going to AA and getting sober, they'd be like, if I had a 9-to-5, they'd be like, cool, good for you. Great. It would be a very weird thing to fire someone over, but it's not even really about that anymore. I think that this is an interesting place to be like because I can see someone's face at a meeting, but like all I know about them is their first name. I don't know where they live. I don't know what they do. I don't know what their job is. I don't, you know, like all I know about them is their first name and that they are an alcoholic like me who has had similar lived experiences as me. And that person is like relaying their lived experience to me that day, and I can take it or leave it. And I can choose to like relate to it and listen to it and try to lean into it, or I can put distance between me and that person and go like, nah, me and that person aren't the same. They don't, you know, that person doesn't get it. That, you know, and there is that, and that sort of anonymity that exists there where like, I'm not going to become friends with this person on social media necessarily. I'm not, you know, like even a lot of people, when they give me their phone number, will just put their last name initial, you know? So it'll be like Ben G, you know? And I'm just like, I'm like talking to Ben every day, but I'm like, I don't know anything about Ben other than
I met Ben G.
It's Ben G at this meeting that I met. I don't know anything about him, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some people that I get to know better, but I think that sort of, you know, depersonalizing the relationship there so that advice becomes easier to take. It's sort of like a relationship that a person has with a therapist sometimes where it's like, this is a better situation for me to bounce ideas off of and use as a sounding board because this person and I don't have an emotional attachment to each other.
Yes.
There's not that intimate connection that makes me that maybe clouds their ability to give me solid objective advice and maybe clouds my ability to receive solid objective advice.
Yeah.
You know, so that is an interesting thing. I will say this though. When you were talking about reading aloud in class and counting the paragraphs till you speak, that resonates so much with me and the feeling of like what it's like. Oh yeah. And what it's like to know that like today you're going to try to share and then you're like listening, paying attention to what everyone else is commenting on and being like, ooh, I like that. I'm going to mention that in my share. I'm going to mention that person said that so that everyone knows that I was listening. And then I'm going to mention the part that this person said in the initial lead so that everyone knows that I listened to that. And then I'm going to tie that into my story of what's going on in my life this way. And you're already doing all this stuff. And there is sort of an ego and fear-based element there of like, if I'm going to speak up, I want my thing to to be good. I want everyone to like notice that like my thing was good and my share stood out. And I think even in a comment section where it's anonymous, I could still have that ego where I'm like, yeah. if I'm gonna share some feedback in this comment section or on this app, I want my thing to like get the most hits. Like I want my thing to like be noticed by the most people. I want people to notice that my thing was like particularly well worded. And
and that's the thing. Like, have you never heard it before? I have heard it before. So why do I feel the need to obtain the information a fifth time or a 10th time or a 100th time, you know? And people hear the word ego and they automatically think that it has to do with some big, you know, chest puffed out, like, you know, super confident, you know, and arrogant. And that's not true. Everybody has an ego. Ego is just, you know, curation and, you know, self-maintenance of our baser instincts and emotions and how we feel about things and how things affect us and whether or not we let those things affect our emotions. So a majority of things that we do or don't do, come from ego-based decisions. And I think trying to simplify things by, you know, like you using anonymity helps because you're starting from a clean slate. Your ego says, well, I don't have anything to prove here. And they don't have anything to prove and they don't know me and I don't know them. It's a lot less in the equation, especially for people that tend to overcomplicate things anyway, like me.
Yeah.
You know, so it's nice to just say, I don't have, you know, it's like when you put your phone down and you just walk away from your phone, all of a sudden the five app rotation that you find yourself locked into, it's not there. So you have to do something else with your time. That's why they say, put your phone face down and walk away from it. Put something on top of your phone, put an empty cup on top of your phone. It's one more step you have to do to get back into the routine. Mm. It's the same with anonymity. You're taking out so many parts of the equation. Your brain says, well, I have to focus on something else since I don't have any, I'm not winning anything. I don't have to prove anything to anyone. I don't have anyone to upset. I can actually just have this honest and true conversation with this person because we don't know each other like that.
Yeah. I've been going to my therapist for over a year and this last session, I learned more about her than I ever had before. It just like started happening where I started asking her questions about her and she was like, oh, you never asked me that. And I was like, should I have? Like all of a sudden in my head, I was all insecure where I was like this whole, and then I felt bad. I was like, this whole time I've just been coming to this woman and talking about myself for like an hour every week. And I've never asked her these questions, but then I was like,
what about her needs?
And I was like, but I literally pay her to listen right. to me talk for an hour. But it was just like, it came, we were talking about like The Last of Us that we're both watching on HBO. And she was like, she's like, well, I played the video game in high school. And as soon as she said that, I was like, you played it in high school? And then I was like, how old are you? And she goes, you've never asked me that. And I was like, well, I always assumed that you and I were like the same age. And I was like, but you're a little younger than me, aren't you? And she was like, I am. She's like, I'm like 4 years younger than you. And I was like, and she was like, is that a problem for you? And I was like, no, no. That's fine.
I just have to do my very best never to think about it again, or I'll come up with some ridiculous conclusions about myself.
Yeah. we talked about like what she did in college, and she was like, she went to college late because she was an athlete, and I was like, you were an athlete, but it's all this stuff that I all this, you know, and then I started thinking like, is that a part of that? Am I supposed to get to know that person like that? I don't know. You know, I think it can't hurt at some point to start to get to know your therapist.
I think so too, but I have a long track record. I used to have a therapist. I don't see her anymore, just for like insurance reasons, but I have this long track record of going in too deep with people. Being friendly, too friendly to friends, being too emotionally engaged early on in the relationship, you know, just getting 10 steps ahead of them. And then they're like, oh, we're playing leapfrog. Cool. I'm going to jump ahead of you now. And then I'm like, ah, you're gross now. I don't like you anymore. It was a big problem for a long time where I hurt a lot of people's feelings doing that. And I started, you know, like getting to know my therapist and like about her personal life. And I'm like, am I doing it again? Am I like breaking records now where I'm like going through the therapist patient barrier and everybody else just, you know, talks about themselves. But here I am once again, overstepping boundaries. I don't know, you know, and it's, again, the overthinking, right? I like to think that, you know, we say that none of our problems are solvable because we've already thought of all the possible solutions that don't work. But the reason that they're unsolvable is because, you know, in your imagination, they have room to evolve to become unsolvable. Mm-hmm. You know, you have plenty of time to think about solutions, but the problem itself has the same elbow room around to grow into something that it's not. Yes. So I've been trying to realize that even though I may be creative with solutions, I'm also creative with the problems and allow other people to at least look at them. I at least like hold them up and I'm like, all right, here it is. You tell me what you think now, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a good first step, I think, is to at least present the problem to somebody else. You don't have to take the advice, but just hear them.
I feel like the opposite of leaning into peer support, being willing to be open to it, being willing to answer the phone when someone calls, being willing to make a phone call yourself, being willing to begin the process of looking for a therapist, all this stuff. It's like, again, seems like simple things, but these can be very, very complicated when you're in the throes of a depressive episode or when you're, you know, incredibly anxious. Reaching out, talking to other people can be very, very difficult. And I feel like the opposite of it is, you know, this idea of isolation. And we know that isolation typically isn't favorable for a lot of low mental health points. What are some things that, what do you feel like happens or goes on in your head when you're feeling like it's harder to reach out and get some peer support? Like what are things that close you off from the idea of being open to peer support, if that makes sense?
I came from a very, very high pedestal, mm-hmm. And fell a very long way down in terms of ego, you know, from the really dark years, right? I came from a sense of extremely inflated self-importance, that everything I did was super important and nobody else could understand because I was doing more important things than them. I was very good at acting humble, but I certainly was not. And I think some of the residual negative like fears from that are typically what get me when I'm alone. You know, like I recently picked up this hobby with paracording where I'm like, you know, making these paracord bracelets and keychains and stuff. And I think there's this, again, this kind of fragment from my old self that fears not being important or not doing important things and wasting time doing not important things. And I'm like, why are you doing this stupid fucking hobby that doesn't do anything for anybody? You know what I mean? And I'm like, because it, I don't know, it just makes me happy. And I'm like having a conversation with myself. Or, you know, nobody is available to hang out on the day that I decided I want to hang out randomly, you know? And I'm like, because they're all doing things and you have the same four friends that you've always had, and you're not going anywhere doing anything, you know? And that just this constant sense that what I'm doing isn't important enough or isn't significant enough, is like one of those egotistical fears for me. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to scale back because you try very hard to say that, If in some circle that you're in, if you're making a difference in those people's lives, you can never control that. That has to be something that they decide, that you've been a positive influence for them. So if you do that, you've already done something that's physically impossible to do by yourself anyway. That's good enough. But so for me, the isolation comes from those little fragments of myself that, you know, the ism doing push-ups in the parking lot waiting for me to fuck up again and realize that I'm not doing all the things that I thought I wanted to do or the goals that I've set for myself. While they looked big, you know, 1,000 yards away, now that they're closer, I realize that they were always the same size and I'm doing small things. Mm. I hate that because the very next day, I won't feel that way. And, you know, for me, it's not even like, obviously I dislike feeling that way in the moment. What I dislike more is whenever I don't feel that way, looking back, I'm like, how was that such a real experience for me? Something that I just do not believe is true was just so true then, you know? And I think anyone that, you know, has disbelief, or maybe not even disbelief, but just a general misunderstanding of things like depression and anxiety and panic attacks and, you know, bipolar disorder, all these things that make you feel these real feelings. That's the only way I can describe it to them. It's just imagine a time when you were blistering angry. Imagine a time when you felt this small or were extremely frightened. Those feelings just manifest. They just do. And it's, you can't see it in people. So it's hard to believe because we're, you know, people of physical substance, we have to see it to believe it. But those feelings that you know that you've experienced before, they just happen illogically. And that I hope people could take that away and just understand, I know the feeling because I've experienced it. That's how they feel a lot of the time. And imagining that, I think, would help people understand why things like isolation happen more than they should.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. I think that's a great place for us to wrap it up. So we've got the first half. We got the second half.
We did it.
We did it. We finished what we started. I'm proud of us. Where can people, people can get the White Flag app. That's an app that's happening right now. And then there's a podcast happening too, right?
Yeah. So, I don't want to talk about me at all, really. I just want to talk about White Flag. So, White Flag is an app. We're only in the US currently, but we're doing some expansion soon. It's an app that you can get in either Play Store. Free anonymous peer-to-peer support. It does not cost money. You can just put in things about yourself and then either raise your flag and ask for support and someone else can answer your call. Or you can go down the list of flags that are already raised. And I would encourage you, if you don't feel the need to raise your flag or if maybe you're not getting an answer fast enough, just to answer somebody else's. I've never answered a flag and had the person say, okay, thanks for the help, bye. You know, they always ask me, well, thank you so much. I appreciate this. How are you? What are you going through? Do you need to talk about something? You know, it's always been reciprocation. So if you, you know, if you're not in that position to raise your own, I would highly recommend answering someone else's. And then the podcast. And we would love to have you on. I think you have a good story that, you know, we could share.
Absolutely. Anytime.
White Flag Warriors, wherever you get them. And it's just true stories of mental health. It's just people sharing the real nitty gritty, kind of like we just talked about, you know, about what you actually go through. And our founder's story was the first three episodes that is out now. And it's pretty wild. So I hope you guys check it out and enjoy.
Sounds great. And let's do talk about you just briefly. People can follow you on social media. Where?
Brave.dave or brave.dave.official. Just look me up. And you should find me somewhere.
They should. It's good stuff. It's fun stuff. It's useful stuff. And I always like watching your videos and chatting with you when I get a chance to. So thanks for making the time to come and do part two and wrap this up with me.
Thank you, man. I learned a lot today.
Me too. It was useful. It was a good way to start my day. So yeah. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad we did this. And thank you to everyone in the chat who watched and who commented. Appreciate you guys. And for anyone just watching the video version, you know, you can support this show at patreon.com/AustinArcher if you would like to support this show and the content that I make on the internet. Tomorrow's Bandcamp Friday, first Friday in March, AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com, or go get some music from your favorite indie artist. Dave, do you have any music on Bandcamp?
I don't, but I was actually waiting for the next Friday to roll around so I could get some of yours because I'm not waiting for this vinyl anymore, Austin. I'm just going to go to Bandcamp.
Yeah, so the vinyl is happening. People have been messaging lately being like, what's going on, man? What happened is they sent me the test pressings for this vinyl and it wasn't right. The master on the vinyl was blown out. I tried it on four different kinds of speakers and on the top end, it kept like distorting, like everything was blown out. So I was like, all right, so it's not working. So they had to remaster everything and get the remasters back to me. I had to re-listen to all of that stuff on different speakers and confirm that sounds right. now we're finally in the process of getting the vinyl press. So it should be a week or two. Like we're very, very close.
Oh, but, okay.
But Bandcamp Friday is tomorrow for anyone yes. who wants to pick up the TikTok albums or anything like that. You know, now that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs, volumes 1 through 4. It's Bandcamp Friday where Bandcamp waives their service fee, gives 100% of sales to the artist. It's a great day to support indie music. That's all the stuff. Anyway.
That's the all stuff, right. folks.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Bye, Dave.
See you.